Our next guest on the program is the author of a number of books, including The Last of the Doughboys and his newest, Back Over There, One American Time Traveler, 100 Years Since the Great War, 500 Miles of Battle-Scarred French Countryside, and Too Many Trenches, Shells, Legends, and Ghosts to Count. Richard Rubin joining us this afternoon. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Rich, and sorry about that subtitle.
No, I enjoyed that. I feel like, just that, and I've read half the book. It's a wonderful read, and let's talk about the war itself first, and your notion that in many ways this is a forgotten war for people in America as we hit this 100th anniversary of American involvement. Why is that the case?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, but I think a lot of it is due to the fact that at a certain point, as you know, once upon a time, remembering that war was terribly important to America and Americans, and Maine is as fine a place as any to realize that. Almost every town I can think of in this state has a World War I memorial, and some of them are quite stately and beautiful. But at a certain point, I think we outsourced our history of America and World War I, and we outsourced it really to the British. If you go to any bookstore today and go to the history section, you'll find that almost every book about World War I is written by a British historian. And the British take a fairly dim view of American participation in World War I because we didn't jump in when they did in 1914. We waited until 1917. And as a result, British history tends really, really downplay the American role in the war. They effectively say that America just came in at the very end to claim credit. That nothing could be further from the truth. But unfortunately, I think a great many Americans have assimilated that and believe it. And if you believe something like that, I don't know why you would want to remember an episode like that.
And in your time in France doing research, you found a very different perspective of not only the war, but American involvement from the people of France.
Oh, absolutely. The first thing I always asked at anybody when I was over there was, vous êtes anglais, parlez-vous anglais, or do you speak English? And nobody ever did. But often they would ask me, vous êtes anglais, are you English? And when I would respond, no, je suis américain, no, I'm American, immediately their face would break into a smile and they would do whatever they could to help me. It seems the French don't much care for the English, but they really love Americans. And that goes back to World War I. They have never forgotten, even though we have, that when things were really looking grim for them and the Allies, it was the Americans who came over. We didn't even share a continent with them. We sailed across an ocean to help them win the war and drive the Germans out. As a woman said to me once, I would not forget that you helped, restore our liberty. And they really believe that. It's almost as if they regard you as having done that for them and not your grandparents or great-grandparents.
In your last book, The Last of the Doughboys, you had an opportunity to speak with some three dozen veterans of World War I, which is just a remarkable story. What was that experience like for you?
You mean other than pinching myself every time I sat across from a 108-year-old man and had him tell me about things he had seen and done 85, 86 years earlier? It was unexpected. It was wondrous. You could almost call it miraculous. I was never able, I think, in all the hundreds of hours of conversations I had with these very, very old men and women, the youngest person I interviewed for that book was 101, and the oldest was 113. I was never able in all of those hours of conversation to really lose myself and lose track of the fact that I was sitting across somebody who was that old and who could have been in those old, grainy, speeded-up black-and-white films we've all seen from World War I. And yet, at the same time, I was, thankfully, able to have real conversations with them about what they had seen and what they had done. And in many, perhaps most cases, their memories were very, very good. much, much better than you would expect from somebody that age. And best of all, I think, was the fact that, you know, you always hear that veterans don't like to talk about their experiences in war. But in hundreds of hours of conversation with these men and women who saw some horrible, horrible things, I heard the equivalent of, I don't want to talk about it, exactly once. And that's it. Everybody was very open with me. And often they would say, you know, I'm telling you about stuff I haven't talked about in 60 or 70 years. And I would ask, why not? And the response often was, no one asked.
We're talking with Richard Rubin. The book is back over there, your newest book, and the return to France for you. And I, like I'm sure a lot of readers, surprised to learn how many artifacts of the war remain there 100 years later.
Oh, it's every time fields are plowed in certain parts of France, and I mean every time, things come up, and a lot of things. And, you know, the impetus for this book actually is a series of talks I gave for The Last of the Doughboys throughout Maine and New Hampshire. I write in public libraries, and so I like to give back by going to speak in public libraries, too, and I gave a lot of talks for Doughboys. And sometimes people would ask me, you know, what is it like over there? I have a PowerPoint presentation with my talks, and one of the slides was a picture of a little American shell that had been plowed up just that morning. And it was small. It was only about half the length of my foot. And it looked so cute that I bent over to try to pick it up. And thankfully, there was a French friend of mine there who prevented me from doing something like that. But people just couldn't believe that these things pop up there. And somebody asked me, you know, is it like Gettysburg? And it couldn't be further from Gettysburg. And so, you know, I went back over there to explore it more and to sort of bring that back to people to see just what it's like.
When I'm not here on the radio, my day job is as a social studies and history teacher, and I've always been drawn by the fact that World War I is in many ways the last of the old European wars with alliances and dukes and duchesses and archdukes, but also the first modern war in terms of the technology that was used. What is it that drew you and has given you this interest in World War I?
Well, honestly, it's exactly that. It's the fact that World War I exists at the crossroad of the ancient and the modern. And it not only exists at those crossroads, but it really is responsible. World War I is what destroyed the old world and created the new world in which you and I and all the rest of us live to this day. You know, if you think about it, when we entered that war, our allies were, a king, and various other dignitaries, and our enemies were an emperor, a kaiser, and an Ottoman sultan. You know, think about that. And yet, this is a war that had tanks and airplanes and flamethrowers and poison gas. It really is sort of the crashing of the old world against the new. And it every day, you know, every hour of every day, you come up against something that's only possible because of that war.
Richard, you play a key role in the PBS American Experience documentary, The Great War. Part one was last night. Parts two and three tonight and tomorrow. I loved the opening edition last night of it. It was phenomenal. How happy were you when the producers reached out to be a part of this? And it seems like they've really done a remarkable job assembling all of this.
Oh, it's a fantastic film. I actually watched it. I've seen clips because I participated in some events for the film, but last night was the first time I saw any of part one. And it's just so beautifully done, which doesn't surprise me because the fellow who made it, a documentarian named Stephen Ives, made probably one of the favorite things of mine that I've ever seen on television, a documentary called The West. From the 1990s. That was a multi-part documentary about the American West. You know, I didn't realize when he reached out to me at first that he wanted me to be in the film. He just wanted to talk about World War I. He had read The Last of the Doughboys and in doing his research on the subject, and he just wanted to pick my brain. And I'm always happy to talk about the subject, so I did. And it was after our second conversation, a long conversation, that he said, you know, I'd like to bring you down to New York and interview you on camera. So, you know, I, of course, was happy to do that. One thing I'm glad to report that did not make the final cut is during our interview, which lasted several hours, at one point he got me talking about the song Over There. And I'm a great fan of that song. I think it's one of the greatest American songs ever written. And I said, the wonderful thing about that song is that you can sing it the first time you hear it. And he said, well, why don't you give us a couple of verses? So forgetting that the camera was on, I just started singing. And I've spent all the months since that interview was done and now terrified that that was going to be included in the documentary. And I found out last week that it very, very nearly was and only got cut at the last minute. So I'm thankful for that.
That's having an editor on your side right there. But, you know, speaking of music, I was really struck with one of your comments last night during part one about the role that music played in the war and how it in many ways was a history book for a lot of people.
Yes, it was more than history. It was news. You know, people don't realize today that even though that was an era of the golden age of print journalism, you know, a city like New York had a great many daily newspapers, and pretty much any city of any size had more than one. Still, there were an awful lot of people who were in no position, for one reason or another, to read a newspaper every day. Some of them couldn't read. Some of them couldn't read English. But you could walk into your local saloon after work and hear somebody singing a song about something that had been in the newspaper that very morning. That's how Tin Pan Alley, the great American songwriting industry of that day, worked, is that guys would take the train into work. Tin Pan Alley was all on a stretch of West 28th Street in Manhattan. And, you know, these guys would take the train into work. They would stop at their local newsstand and pick up three or four newspapers on their way into the office. They would read them to see what had happened. They would write a song about one of the stories by lunchtime, and it would be published and for sale on the street by the end of that day. And that's really how a lot of people got their news back then. It's strange to think now, but it's really true. And then, of course, once America enters the war, songwriting is recruited for propaganda purposes.
Well, if you'd like to do even just a chorus of Over There, you know, we're more than open to that.
You know, if we were in a bar and you give me a few drinks, you probably would get that.
All right. We have a plan for next time, then. That's outstanding. I could talk to you all day. It's a fascinating subject. A wonderful book, Back Over There, and a tremendous work on the documentary, The Great War, Part 2, airs tonight on PBS, The American Experience. Richard Rubin, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. And let me just say that, first of all, I love speaking about the war. I already have a bunch of engagements lined up around the state for this new book, but, you know, I'd be happy to go speak about it anywhere. And my first talk will be at the Maine Historical Society in Portland at 7 p.m. on April 20th next week.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Richard, thank you again. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.